Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, welcome. Well, today we're spanning the bridge between science and spirituality, and later in the show we'll be looking at the arts. My first guest is Dr. Leo Kim. His frustration as a scientist developing new cancer treatment drugs led him on a long journey looking for life's big questions about life and death. He wanted to bridge the gap between science and spirituality. Did he find the answers to those universal questions that many of us have asked throughout the ages? Well, stay tuned and we'll find out. My second guest coming later in the hour is award-winning filmmaker, author, and speaker, Roberta Marie Monroe. She's a Sundance Film Festival programmer. It's been said that she knows more about short film than anyone on the planet. And while she denies that, she is proud of helping hundreds of short filmmakers realize their dreams. Roberta's joining us to discuss what makes not just a good film, but a good story and a good filmmaker. And we'll also get some inside viewpoints on the Sundance Film Festival she's just got back from. So let me introduce my first guest. Dr. Leo Kim is a scientist and biotechnology executive with over 50 scientific publications and patents to his credit. Leo's journey includes research and management in chemistry, biochemistry, biotechnology, and the list is endless. He's been active in new pharmaceutical and biotechnology disease treatments, as well as alternative medicine. And he studied with Deepak Chopra, Bernie Siegel, and many others who offer spiritually based alternatives to traditional healing. Dr. Leo Kim, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for hanging me on.
And I should have said, you've written this book answering or about your journey. It's called Healing the Rift, Bridging the Gap Between Science and Spirituality. So I wanted to ask you, I mentioned at the beginning that you were frustrated treating cancer patients. You were actually researching new drugs, as I understand it, and you felt frustration watching them die, and you decided to go on this journey. What was the journey about when you first set out? What was your purpose? What was the question in your mind that was burning?
Well, you know, I was the traditional cancer drugs are poisons, and the idea is to poison the cancer before you poison and kill the patient. And I was dealing with, and I still am, with the modern-day drugs that uses the body's own defense systems. But then upon seeing clinical trials all across the United States and people suffering and dying, one young woman's death really catalyzed two things. First, I asked myself, what does science really teach about the big questions, such as how did everything begin? How did life begin? What is life? What is death? Is there anything after death? And science doesn't have the answers to any of those questions, is the short answer. But I studied what they do teach for the last 30 years. Now, also obsessively, I tackled spirituality and religions and wanted to see what their teachings were. And initially, it was with the typical scientific skepticism. But then, over the years, over 25 years, I came to the realization that things are really, really different than most people suppose. And in the last 10 years, science has been turned on its head. Never before in history has science been in such upheaval. And this upheaval is causing the blackboard to be wiped clean and numerous scientific dogma that has created the rift between science and spirituality is gone now.
How exciting is that?
I'm sorry?
I was going to say, how exciting is that for you as a scientist?
Oh, it's super exciting. And having studied the spiritual side and then all of a sudden getting the light bulb going on and having the realization that the scientist's dogma is being buried and being replaced with a, you can say, a spiritual a perspective that has been taught for millennia. Now, scientists demand reproducibility. If something works in California, it better work in Australia.
Right.
Now, what's interesting is the spiritual concepts that I talk about in the book were found at various times throughout the world in African tribes people, Mesoamericans, American Indians, Australian Aborigines, all the major religions. And I think, you know, we're in a time now in this country and the world where a lot of rifts need to be healed. And rifts need to be healed not by focusing on differences, but on commonality. And that was the purpose of the book, to get Nobel Prize winners, leaders in scientific fields, along with spiritual leaders, and chronicle the commonality. And lo and behold, it's very exciting, especially with the new developments in science.
Now, I know you've devoted your life to science, but how long did this journey take you when you were trying to bridge that gap between science and spirituality?
Since 1981.
A long time.
Yes.
Well, we're going to take a break, Leo. And when we come back, I'd like to look at some of those theories that you tested and see what your conclusions were. And, if you had any surprises along the way. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest today is Dr. Leo Kim. His new book is called Healing the Rift, Bridging the Gap Between Science and Spirituality.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Coming Monday, February 9th on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Academy Award-winning filmmaker, playwright, and New York Times bestseller Garv Stein. If you love dogs, a good story, and like to laugh a lot and cry a little, you'll find yourself transported in the art of racing in the rain. Garv Stein lives right here in Seattle and joins Vicky next Monday at noon on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See guest schedule at conversationslive.net.
Commune with the Pop Oracle on the Radio 8 Ball Show. I'm Andras Jones, the host of the Radio 8 Ball Show, where we answer your questions by picking songs at random and interpreting them as the answers, like picking musical tarot cards. That's the Radio 8 Ball Show on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Don't miss the Radio 8 Ball Show, Fridays at noon, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150.
Click the shows page on 1150kknw.com for the scoop on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Dr. Leo Kim. He's a scientist who went on a long journey to answer life's big questions. Well, we'll see if he did answer them throughout this section, but he certainly had a lot of questions. Leo, I know you looked at the Big Bang, you looked at creationism. Were there any surprises there for you when you compared science to spirituality? What were your conclusions on creationism, the Big Bang?
Oh, there were dozens and scores of surprises. First of all, the odds of the Big Bang was noted by the leading mathematician in the world, who claimed the odds were winning the lottery, where your chances were 1 in a billion, but you had to win it 100 trillion times in a row without losing it, without losing once.
Wow.
So that's kind of interesting, and you know.
So that would be a no, right?
Right. If scientists claim that you know, the odds of spirituality or religious teachings is being low, that's surprising too. But you know what really has happened in the last 10 years? It's only been 10 years. The scientists discovered 4 startling things. Number one and number two is 96% of our universe is missing. Now, it isn't that they misplaced it. They just can't find it. It's dark energy and dark matter that they need to have to make their equation self-consistent. But that isn't enough. They also need an infinite number of parallel universes, perhaps in the same space as ours. But that isn't enough. There's also 7 other dimensions that are required. All 4 of these are required, and any one of which really sounds like bad science fiction. This is, I think, startling to a lot of people. There's a lot of people wondering about, you know, why spend billions of dollars on the particle accelerator in Switzerland and other space probes. But the exciting thing is all of this is leading to the conclusion that that scientists had since the 17th century, that everything is made up of billiard ball-like atoms comprising molecules that make up our brain, and our brain creates mind. And, of course, that sort of sounds logical. It's just like a little girl who comes in the room, first time seeing a television, and looks at the television. It's on Channel 5, and it's the news. The father wants to find something she'd be interested in. Flips it to 10. Oh, it's a talk show. Flips it to 15, and it's a cartoon. And she just is so amazed. That's wonderful. That box creates all of those things instantly. All you have to do is flip the number.
Mm-hmm.
But we all know that isn't true. What happens is that box picks up the electromagnetic energy from the universe and translates it into something we understand. Well, the box on our shoulders does a very similar thing, but even better. Until the mid-80s, the dogma was, after adolescence, the brain is hardwired and it could be changed. But psychologists found with OCD patients that with mindful meditation, the brain could be rewired and OCD eliminated or reduced. And since then, it's been called brain plasticity and shown in many, many disease states to be extremely useful. Now, so brain doesn't create mind. Mind creates brain.
So let me ask you this, because you talk in the book about the placebo effect and say that in many cases the placebo effect actually has a better result in some cases than the actual trials, the clinical trials.
Yes.
You also talk about, I think it's pronounced the nocebo effect.
Yes.
The negative power of suggestion. How does that affect our brain?
Well, it just shows how powerful our mind is. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to write a book that would teach people the empowerment they have in their mind and how they can use their mind for so many positive things. How they could use their mind to, you know, really reveal their passions, their purpose, find greater happiness, and really show, and I chronicle it, the healing mind, how changing one's mind can and does change the brain, one's health, and one's life.
And you discuss hypnosis, meditation, prayer, love, all as healing methods, and,
yes.
And you're saying there is scientific rationale behind that?
Yes. And again, I chronicle it with not anecdotal cases, but with Nobel Prize-winning references to peer-reviewed journals. And most people are surprised that in the 21st century in my book, there are 2 very outstanding studies on afterlife. And since then, about 6 weeks ago, there was a third study initiated. Now, the first study in my book talks about a cardiologist who did a 12-year clinical trial that was published in the prestigious British medical journal Lancet, that showed that when people had a cardiac failure where there's no breathing, no heart rate, and no brain function, how they could recall what went on when they were literally dead. So consciousness without brain function. Now, that spawned this clinical trial that I just mentioned. I started about 6 weeks ago in 25 institutions in Western Europe, Canada, and United States. Will eventually involve 1,500 patients to study that phenomena. Now, isn't that interesting?
It is interesting. What does science say about human auras? You know, people claim that they can see auras, that people have different colored auras around them. What does science say about that now?
Okay. Back when I started studying this, and I studied with some of the best, it was all foo-foo, new age stuff. What science says now, and what no physicist would deny, is we all create electromagnetic radiation, our brains, our hearts, our body. And it's radiated to the universe, and it will continue to radiate to the universe forever. And that's known. In fact, there's an outfit in Great Britain developing a machine that can be put in a hospital to measure those energies, or the aura, whatever you want to call it, so it could be in the room about 10 or 15 feet away from the patient without any wires, and basically be able to monitor all of the body functions. So in reality, every thought you have, every emotion, every memory is radiated into the universe.
Interesting. Many, many people have, including scientists, have written books citing that science proves that God does not exist. This was one of your questions on your search. Where do you stand on this now?
Well, you know, Richard Dawkins wrote last year the best-selling book, The God Delusion. The problem is he is under the delusion of 17th and 18th century science, which is materialism, like I talked about earlier, that everything is made up of material things. But we know now in the 21st century that material things constitutes only less than 4% of what's out there. And scientists really don't know what the rest is. And when you examine Dawkins' book and other atheists and others who make those contentions, they have nothing other than the belief that it's too ridiculous. And it's based on materialism. And he, in grasping as to a concept on why God doesn't exist, he talks about parallel universes in his book, which I find very interesting.
So do you believe there is a God? Do you believe in a portal to the spiritual?
What I believe in is our minds are, you know, that box sitting on our shoulders receives so much static. You know, remember to pick up the bread on the way home. you got an appointment this afternoon. And, oh, by the way, Saturday I better do this. Those cloud the issues. And the reason I mentioned earlier, every culture we're able to access the spiritual is by quieting the mind. And when the mind is quiet, then that receiver on your shoulder picks up what's out there. And what's out there, first of all, is you can find out your spiritual self. You can find out who you really are without all this noise. And with that, you can really determine what is important in your life, how you run your life. And, you know, all the religions say, you know, what's really out there is energy, spirit, soul, and God. Now, I don't think anybody, a scientist or a spiritualist or a religion, should be so audacious to say they know exactly what's out there. But what is interesting is science has now come to the point where it's agreeing with the all spiritual teachings of 10,000 years ago.
Oh, isn't that interesting? So after your exploration, Leo, how do you describe death now in comparison with how you described it before as a scientist?
Death now is one where one should realize not to fear, that one's energy, the energy that every moment of our life, every emotion, every thought, everything would be radiating through the universe forever. And that when people suffer cardiac arrest, for some reason, upon a revival, they can actually retrieve what happened when they were dead. So what's really out there is spirit. And in 2005, in the most prestigious scientific journal in the world, Nature, a professor, and it's in my book with a reference, Richard Henry, an astrophysicist, said, you know, the problem is when you think about death and about all of these religious things or scientific things, scientists forget these are not things. What's really out there is mental and spiritual. He says, this is the universe we live in.
Okay. You have a whole chapter devoted to afterlife. Explain a little bit more on that. If you say it's not physical, it's mental and spiritual. Is there actually an afterlife? Do you believe in an afterlife?
Yes. And actually, there were two 21st century scientific studies that are referenced in the book. And there are many, many other cases in the book. And then I mentioned 6 weeks ago, another one was started, a clinical trial. People are really, and these are scientists, these are world-class scientists and physicians, are beginning to ask the question, what is that mental, spiritual stuff out there? Mm. And how does that affect, and how does that relate to afterlife?
One of the questions you raise in the book is, is it important how you die? What was your conclusion on that?
I think how you live and how you die is very important. And I think the best way to access and to discover the best way to live and the best way to die is to really quiet that mind. Could be with prayer, could be with meditation. There's a lot of devices, and that's I believe a commonality that spiritual teachings teach.
Okay, we're talking with Dr. Leo Kim. His new book is called Healing the Rift: Bridging the Gap Between Science and Spirituality. I wanted to ask you, Leo, I love the jacket of your book. It has it looks like a series of clouds with an elephant walking on top of the clouds. What is the significance of that?
There is an ancient Hindu parable. It's about 4,000 years old, and in it, I think a lot of people have quoted it in some form or another, but the parable of about 4,000 years ago the Hindus had was there were seven blind men. They were all feeling an elephant. Of course, they were feeling different parts, the tail, the trunk, the tusk, the leg, the body, the ears. And they were all arguing about what it is that was. And what we have now is science, spirituality, religion, we're all living in this world. And like that elephant in the clouds, we're all blind, and we don't know what that other 96% of the universe is. We don't know about parallel universes or those other seven dimensions. And yet we all feel we know what we're experiencing, and we're arguing with each other. And what we ought to be doing, and what I try to do in the book, is put in lay terms the commonality of what everybody is teaching and how useful to everyone's life these teachings are. That's the meaning of the elephant in the clouds.
I like that. You say at the end of the book, love is the only eternal truth. I wonder if you'd share what you mean by that.
Yeah, I sort of try to crescendo to that. There was a physician by the name of Strauss who studied for years and then wrote a book on the 100 most outstanding and important medical breakthroughs in history. And one, the number one one, made all the other 99 possible. And it was when, at different times and different places, the healers went from shunning and fearing the patient to compassion and love. So here we have, without compassion and caring by the physician, none of the others. And we have fantastic ones. We have penicillin, we have cancer cures, we have many, many, and many of which I've been involved in. But isn't it interesting that the most important medical discovery in the history of man was going from fear to love?
It is interesting.
Now, then I talk about, I was fortunate enough to study with Bernie Siegel, and we talk about how Bernie, his experiences with AIDS patients and cancer patients, and when I studied with him, there were many of those, and we discussed love and the importance of the presence or absence of love in disease. And interestingly enough, in the clinical trials that are just beginning now, we don't have time to talk about, and but I will be writing about, is how love and compassion and the mind, the healing power of the mind, when used with 21st century medicine, is so, so powerful. And in my opinion, the healing power of the mind is going to be the number one event of the 21st century. We've spent billions putting people in space and hundreds of billions trying to come up with new drugs. But I think when we harness the power of the mind individually with healthcare, it'll be amazing. And then when we can learn how to collectively use the power of the mind, we will be in a new era.
Wouldn't we be in a new era? Did your journey, I mean, it spanned over 20-odd years, 8 years. How did it raise more questions for you than answers? Or do you feel that you've answered most of the questions you set out to?
No, I think the big questions will always be unanswered. We may inch towards a little bit more insight towards them, but the one thing that I think I've learned that's the most important message, number one, is the power of the mind and how we can all use it. Number two is how we must guard against focusing on differences, focusing on dogma. And if we focus on commonality and what the end game is, what the positive role that our lives are for, and how all spiritual and scientific teachings teach the same thing, that is really the important message.
Yeah, it's a very good message, too. And it's a good note to end our segment on. I want to give out your website. And I know chatting with you in the break, you said that you do answer all emails if listeners have any specific questions for you. So let's give out your contact information, if we could.
Sure. My website is healingtheriftbook.com. And I answer all my emails, leo@healingtheriftbook.com.
Okay, thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Leo Kim, and sharing some of your journey with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
And we're going to take a very quick break. We'll be right back with our next guest, Roberta Marie Monroe. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Looking for new fiction authors? Or a different kind of book? For good writing that challenges the mind, the heart, the spirit? Then check out Book Talk Podcasting at 1150kknw.com. Book Talk brings you weekly bite-sized book reviews brought to you by Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
You can listen to Book Talk podcasts at 1150kknw.com or anytime by downloading them to your MP3 player. If you'd like to try your hand at submitting a review, email info@conversationslive.net for more information. To listen to Book Talk, go to 1150kknw.com and click on podcasting. It's that simple.
This station is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My next guest is Roberta Marie Monroe. She's an award-winning filmmaker, writer, entrepreneur, international short film festival programmer, consultant, and now published author. Her first book is called How Not to Make a Short Film, Secrets from a Sundance Programmer. Roberta, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
Yeah, well, we're pleased to have you here, and you've certainly hit a winner with this book.
Oh, thank you.
I have quite a few books on film on my shelves in my studio, and this had some really great information in there. But I want to start with your background a little. You have over 15 years' experience in international film festivals, programming short films. You've viewed over 15,000 short films during your career, considered by many to be the go-to expert in the world of short-form filmmaking. You seem to have developed this wonderful lifestyle and career for yourself that many would envy. How did your career in film begin?
Well, you know, actually, I started in Toronto. I'm originally Canadian. I'm from Toronto, Canada. And I started working at the Toronto Lesbian and Gay Film Festival as a coordinator, director of administration. And I quickly, you know, I loved it, and it was wonderful to work with filmmakers, and I knew I've always been a writer and always wanted to put, you know, what I my creativity in the visual medium, which was, it was a wonderful opportunity that I got in Toronto. And then I moved to Viacom Canada, where I was an executive assistant to the president, and had the opportunity to work with some amazing, not just filmmakers, but industry people who were working in film at that time. And then I was able to take my vacation from Viacom Canada and work at the Toronto Film Festival in the industry theater. And that was a whole new world of filmmaking and film lovers, and it was just a wonderful experience. So that's where I started off. And then I moved to New York and programmed No Borders at IFP at their market in New York City, and worked at New Fest. And that's when I really thought to myself, I am going to make a movie.
Well, you might as well. You're helping make everybody else's, right?
Yeah.
So you made your first movie when?
I made my first, well, you know, it's funny because I do talk about it a little bit in the book in the end, but I did make I made a short on video, got all my friends together in Toronto, and we shot for 14 hours in one day and shot 14 pages. And in my move from Toronto to New York, I lost the tapes.
Oh.
Yes, and so this was prior to Final Cut Pro and prior to being able to back it up onto your computer, and I just was heartbroken. But I moved on, and then I got into, once I moved out to Los Angeles, I got into the Fox Searchlight Director's Lab, which is called Fox Search Lab, and I made Danny and Alice in 2004, and was able to, and that was a whole other experience. I made that on 35mm and had an amazing producer, Effie Brown, and it was a completely different experience than my one-day shoot in my friend's restaurant back in Toronto.
So what's the average length of a short, a good short?
A good short. I'm glad you clarified. the average length of a good short, you know, it really does depend. You know, there's always exceptions to the rule. But I tell first-time filmmakers, really try to keep it between 8 and 12 minutes if it's a narrative. You have a little bit more leeway when it's a documentary or even animation. But I think that keeping it between 8 and 12 minutes, you've got a good chance.
Mm. Now, besides the length of the film, what are some of the primary differences between a regular feature film and a short?
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, many producers will say there's no difference in the amount of work that is necessary, that's required to make a short film. But I think, you know, structurally, shorts are very different than features. In feature films, you generally have three acts, and you have certainly the first 30 minutes to introduce all your characters and have us fall in love with them or hate them or somehow be emotionally connected to these people. And then you have a whole other hour for this film to play out. Whereas with a short, we kind of, you know, you have to use a lot of different devices and the way of writing in order to get us involved in that first minute, 2 minutes.
So what attracted you to making short films versus features?
Well, you know, it's a number of reasons. And one of them would definitely be budget. I think if you're an up-and-coming filmmaker and you want to just get out there and make a movie, it's a lot easier to gather people around to work with you for free or close to free for 3 or 4 days as opposed to 5 or 6 weeks.
Right.
Yeah.
I just watched a full-length feature with Ed Harris directed and wrote and starred in it. And Renee Zellweger was in it and Jeremy Irons. I mean, some really great actors. And they basically said they worked for nothing. You know,
yes.
But they have the time to commit.
They have the time to commit and the bank account to back up that working
exactly.
For nothing.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yes.
So let's look at what goes into making a good short. And you say it begins with story and characters. What are you looking for there? As a programmer, if you're looking to program films into, say, the Sundance Film Festival, what are you looking for?
Well, one of the things that I believe as a programmer I learned a great deal at all the festivals that I worked at, but most significantly at Sundance, what I learned under the wise tutelage of John Cooper and Trevor Groth and Mike Plant, who I worked with there, was that you're not here to say whether this film is good or bad. You're here to say whether or not this filmmaker has realized their vision. Has the director come up with a fresh story that they were able to cast properly? They had an amazing crew. They had a great director of photography. And ultimately had a really great editor and post-production staff who helped them realize a vision. So that's what I'm looking for, someone who really believes in the story they're telling and is able to fulfill that, you know, that vision with some rock-solid production.
Mm. Now, I just mentioned a film where Ed Harris starred, wrote, directed. But you say on a short film, that's always a red flag to you if you see the name and, you know, he was the producer and the director and the writer and the star. How come?
Well, you know, I mean, Ed Harris is, you know, I'm guessing around 60.
Well,
and he's been working.
A lot of business.
A
lot of business.
He's been working
in
this industry for probably 40 years and has worked with some of the top directors in this industry and probably has a lot more experience than someone just coming out of film school or, you know, a first-time filmmaker who is uploading their work onto YouTube. So having said that, I think that what you learn is, or what I've learned certainly in making films, is that filmmaking really is a collaborative experience. And the more collaboration with with really smart people, the better your film is going to be. When I see films that have been written, directed, produced, and edited, and often, you know, shot by one person, then you have a very singular viewpoint for this film. And I've learned, after speaking with hundreds of filmmakers, many of whom have gotten into top tier festivals, or even if they didn't, get a great agent or manager from their work, always surrounded themselves with other genius filmmakers. And I believe filmmakers can be not just the director, it can be the producer, it can be the editor, it can be your post-production, you know, supervisor. You really want to branch out and create a community and surround yourself with people who are, you know, super talented and believe in your vision.
Yeah, just like life in general, really, business in general.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, Vicky, you're absolutely right. I surround myself in my personal life and my professional life with people who don't necessarily think like I think, but whose opinion and philosophies I truly believe are genius.
Yes, and I think that's a good point, that they don't necessarily need to think like you. One of the best bosses I ever had looked at me one day and said, don't be afraid to speak up, because we always agree one of us is unnecessary. And I think that's very true in any creative
Fantastic advice. Yes, absolutely.
You say in the book, nothing brings me more joy than seeing the success of other people and helping them achieve their goals.
Yes.
I want to create films that inspire others, and whether it's creating my own work or helping someone else to realize their true cinematic vision, that's the place where I feel most at home. What does that do for you?
Wow, I wrote that? That sounds fantastic. Wonderful. Well, you know, it's funny. I think that I've always sought out mentors, whether they were mentors that I knew in person or mentors that from afar, that inspired me in some way to know that no matter what, if I don't give up, I'm going to get to my ultimate goal. You know, there's going to be challenges along the way, and certainly filmmaking is one of those arenas. It's a very tough business to be in, and from every aspect, you know, whether it's the creative or the financial, it's a tough business to be in. However, if you can reach out and find mentors, whether it's me by reading my book, or it's, you know, your best friend who's going to be your DP, or your, you know, favorite film school teacher, or one of your favorite directors, and you just watch all their work, and you're inspired by that, I think ultimately, that's what's going to bring you the greatest success.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it really, it sounds cliche, you know, I write about cliches in my book, but it really is my life's goal. It really makes me happy. It's like what keeps me going every day.
Yeah, I love the photo on your website. I thought, there is a happy lady.
Yeah, well, you know what they say, when you do what you love, you know, it's everything just feels so much easier.
It does. It shines through. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'd like to look at some of the elements in the book and talk about some of the issues that you talk about. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Roberta Marie Monroe, and her book is called How Not to Make a Short Film, Secrets from a Sundance Programmer. Stay with us, please. We'll be right back.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Coming Monday, February 16th on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, successful author and entrepreneur Omar Tyree. When Omar told people he was a writer, they asked if he had a day job. He's now recognized as one of the most renowned contemporary writers in the literary community. Omar joins Vicky for The Equation, how to take what you love and build it into a successful and financially rewarding life. That's coming Monday, February 9th at noon on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Don't touch that dial. You might miss something life-changing. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live. Eric, I do not know where you find this music from, but thank you for that. That was great. And my guest is Roberta Marie Monroe. Roberta Marie Monroe, How Not to Make a Short Film, Secrets from a Sundance Programmer. So I know you just, you were out at the Sundance Film Festival last month. Did you have fun?
I had a great time, yes.
How could you not?
The weather was beautiful. Beach weather for Park City. We were all very excited about it.
Ooh. So let's look at some of the elements that make good story. Because I think we go through phases, it seems. I'm thinking of feature films now, but I'm sure it's the same in short film. We seem to go through phases where we have all these films with special effects and absolutely no storyline. So what makes good story?
Well, write what you know, definitely. I think we as creative types, we tend to be sitting at home in our rooms alone or with our dogs writing these scripts. And the second thing I would always say is that you need to get your work seen by other people. The way to create a great story is to not, we're all some of us are better storytellers than others, and to know if you are a good storyteller, number one, and then get your work out there and send it to a friend or send it to a consultant or, you know, just get someone other than your best friend or your mom to read your script. Mm. So that tends to, you know, once you broaden your reach, you know, and ask people, you know, this is, I send my scripts out all the time. All the time. I have, you know, a close group of friends who I admire as filmmakers and as writers, and sometimes those, you know, there's a little bit of an ouch moment when I get their notes back, but it always makes my story better. It always keeps me on my toes, and I think sometimes, you know, it takes courage to step way outside the box.
Yeah.
And when you reach out to your community, I think you find that courage.
And you say in the book, not in these exact words, but you say to the effect of, if you think your first draft is brilliant, think again.
Right. Because we all do. Genius. I'm a genius. But, you know, after you make a few films, you realize that that first draft really is just a blueprint for where you're going to ultimately go.
Now, if somebody, you mentioned if people don't have a good support group around, you know, in the business, send the script out to a consultant. And I've seen a lot of people ripped off by not going to legitimate consultants.
Mm-hmm.
How do you recommend they find a consultant? Well, you are a consultant too, right? Is that right?
Yes.
Is that
yes,
the kind of,
yes.
Yeah.
I believe that, but also too, even though that's, you know, I certainly do that for a living and I have a lot of really great clients who produce great work, I also tell my clients before they ever write a check to me to know exactly what they're seeking from me so that they're not sending me the first draft of their script, that first draft actually has gone through a couple of phases and now we're at the third draft and they want to send it to a professional. So I would say before you write a check, you know, go the free route, you know, reach out to your community. And then when you want to do the polish, then reach out to a professional. One of the, you know, it's so tough because there's so many people out there who purport to be experts, particularly in the short field. And because short film market is exploding and there's so many more opportunities for short filmmakers or people working in a short format, I think there's, you know, the equally number of people who are out there saying that they can help you. I would get references. I would reach out to you, you know, within your community. At the back of my book, I have a whole resource list. And it doesn't matter where you live. You don't have to live in Los Angeles or Seattle or Miami to create a filmmaker community because we have the internet. And just reaching out, you know, going online and becoming members at Filmmakers Alliance or at Find, you know, here in Los Angeles. There's so many filmmaker community websites. Indiegogo is a brand new one that's so awesome that I have a lot of friends who've just signed up for that. And I was on a panel, actually, with Slava Rubin, who is one of the founders of Indiegogo. You can create a community, reach out, and get references. And also, you know, you can get some of those people to take a look at your script.
Yeah. Excuse me. I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
I was sick last week. I'm still recovering. It just caught me all of a sudden. So I wanted to ask you this. You have some great resources in the back of your book. And I've got loads of, I said, you know, I've got, I don't know, a dozen or more books on my shelves on film, but I've never seen one with so many great resources. So
thank you.
If somebody's seriously looking, then this would be a great book to pick up. I wanted to talk about cliched characters, because I said in the break, that's my pet peeve, and
yes.
I can never get into a film if there are cliched characters there. How does a filmmaker avoid that?
Well, you know, I mean, one of my favorite examples is the guy, you know, I do write about it in the book, when I talk about, you've got the guy who gets out of bed, he's slovenly, he's wearing, you know, like a ratty Rolling Stones t-shirt and boxers, and either he smokes or he, you know, just makes coffee. And we know that this is the guy with barely a dream who's never able to realize it,
mm-hmm.
the underachiever.
Mm-hmm.
And so we know that. And certainly short filmmakers try to show us fairly quickly, because that's their job, to introduce us to this character. But if I know that, then I've already seen this character 100 times. For me to know that that's what you're trying to tell me in this film. And, you know, I think that filmmakers really, it would behoove them to actually step outside of their comfort zone, step outside of anything they've seen before, and show me who this character is in a fresh way. And also, I mean, I think that one of the ways, I think one of the reasons that you see so many cliched characters, you know, that we've seen a million times is because filmmakers are not going out there and watching work that is already out there, which is so easy to do now. You can go on Netflix. You can go on so many different websites and Juice, Babelgum, like they're endless, and watch work by other filmmakers. You can watch free Sundance shorts on iTunes.
Yeah, so get to know the business.
Exactly. And get to know what's already being made so that you are not remaking something that has already had success.
Yeah, and you actually have about 5 pages of top short filmmaker cliches, just a list of them at the back
right.
of the book, which was really interesting.
Right. Well, you know, Mike Plant, who was my partner in crime for 4 years out of the 5 that I was at Sundance, we, you know, would talk every day on the phone, you know, 20 times a day and email 50 times, and we, you know, would pass shorts back and forth. And he started this email train saying, you know, that filmmakers should have to put on their submission form if any of these, you know, any of these cliche storylines are in their film, and then we don't have to watch it. And so then, you know, we all got on board, and, you know, Cooper added a few, and I remember Elizabeth Richardson, who was at Sundance at the time, added a few, and I, you know, certainly had my whole list. And I wanted to share that with the filmmaking community to let them know that really we have seen this film hundreds of times.
Mm. What's the difference between a director and a producer for those who aren't clear? I think producers become like the most overused word in the English language. But
well, and it's funny because, you know, producer is the most important person in your crew. And finding a great producer is key for any director. So the director is the person generally who wrote the script. Particularly in short films, it's often the person who wrote the script and who's going to direct the actors, who has a vision, who knows what kind of style they want, what kind of camera work they're looking for, kind of production design. They have a vision. And then producer is sometimes it's a line producer who takes care of both roles, producer and line producer. Line producer takes care of the budget and hiring crew. And the producer takes care of they're like the overseer, mm-hmm. and helping with the director with their creative vision. And in short films, they're often the person finding you free stuff.
So well, that's always important.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a great idea to have a producer who's produced feature films, who has, you know, has already got a whole address book of people that they can reach out to help you make your movie.
Yeah. You talk about the importance of structure in the book, and you say the rules are different for documentary films. Let's just compare those very quickly, if we could.
Sure. Well, you know, documentaries have the luxury of being longer in short films because we need more time. These are real people telling real stories, and you don't want to cut them short because of time frame, you know, time issues. And I think that there are a lot more layers to documentary filmmaking than narrative filmmaking. And oftentimes, documentary filmmakers have, you know, 200 hours of footage, whereas a short film, you know, a narrative filmmaker would have a couple of hours worth of footage to be cutting together.
Yeah. And I think the thing, I think you mentioned this in the book as well, but the thing that a lot of people forget when they're making a documentary is that they're still telling a story.
Yes.
And good characters are good characters, whether they're fiction or nonfiction.
Yes, and good filmmaking. I think that oftentimes documentary filmmakers think that if they just pull out their camera and start shooting with a very compelling subject, that's going to get them into the top festivals. And oftentimes, you know, we're not just looking for that compelling subject. We're looking for really great filmmaking.
Yeah, that's
style,
true.
Style, tone, music, editing, everything.
Yeah. So film festivals, we're almost at the end of the show, but
sure.
Are they worth entering? What's the value to a filmmaker?
I think, I mean, it's your theatrical release if you're a short filmmaker. It's, you know, where you get to show your film all over the world and create an audience and a following for your work. It's, you know, immeasurable, the greatness of being at film festivals. I would say for short filmmakers, I would tell them, apply to all the festivals that don't charge a submission fee first.
Right.
And do that round first. And then, you know, definitely have a budget for film festival submissions.
Yeah, so you can learn from any comments that come back from the free ones before you make your
exactly.
paid
and
submissions.
Sometimes you will get feedback from programmers if they have the time to let you know why they didn't select your film or why they did select your film.
Mm. Well, I really appreciate you being with us today, talking about one of my favorite subjects.
Oh, wonderful.
But what would you like to leave our listeners with today, Roberta? I do want to give out your website because you have a blog on there and there's good information up there, too.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. Well, the website is hownottomakeashortfilm.com. You can also go to robertamonroe.com. They go to the same place. And what I'd like to leave your listeners with is that, you know, the book isn't just for professional filmmakers, that there's whole sections and information there for your, you know, dad who's out there making home movies and wants the kids to, you know, be watching them 20 years from now. There's information on, you know, what to do in problem situations when you run into issues when you're on production, and that it really is a super fun book. And I hope that people, and please, and yes, definitely email me. You can email me directly from my website, hownottomakeashortfilm.com. And I try to respond as quickly as possible, but I do respond to everyone. And it's my pleasure. And thank you so much, Vicki. This has been wonderful.
Well, thank you. We didn't even cover a fraction of what is in this book.
You'll have to have me back.
I will. It is one of the best books I've read on how not to make a short film.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and Secrets from a Sundance Programmer. And that's the full title, How Not to Make a Short Film. Secrets from a Sundance Programmer, Roberta Marie Monroe. Has been my guest. And I want to thank you for listening in today. We will be back next week with all new programming. Thanks to Eric Ryder for keeping us live and to the JMB Group for their continued support of Conversations Live. We'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Coming Monday, February 16th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, successful author and entrepreneur Omar Tyree. When Omar told people he was a writer, they asked if he had a day job. He's now recognized as one of the most renowned contemporary writers in the literary community. Omar joins Vicki for The Equation, how to take what you love and build it into a successful and financially rewarding life. That's coming Monday, February 9th at noon on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Coming Monday, February 9th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Academy Award-winning filmmaker, playwright, and New York Times bestseller Garth Stein. If you love dogs, a good story, and like to laugh a lot and cry a little, you'll find yourself transported in the art of racing in the rain. Garth Stein lives right here in Seattle and joins Vicki next Monday at noon on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See guest schedule at conversationslive.net.